On the cover flap of Debbie Applegate's 2021 book, Madam, the biography of Polly Adler, icon of the jazz age, is written the following, quote, "Simply put, everybody went to Polly's. Polly Adler, who lived 1900 to 1962, was a diminutive dynamo whose Manhattan brothels were more than oasis of illicit sex, where men paid top dollars for the company of her girls," unquote. According to author Debbie Applegate, Polly's pals included Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Frank Sinatra, Desi Arnaz, and Duke Ellington, among many others. Applegate is an Amherst and Yale-educated historian based in New Haven, Connecticut. Debbie Applegate, I heard you recently say, as I was preparing for this interview, again, that I will never write another book. Is that true?
Well, in fact, you're calling me in the middle of an existential crisis as I think, what the heck am I going to do with the rest of my life? The idea of setting out for one of these long around-the-world voyages that I seem to insist on taking doesn't sound like a very good idea. I'm getting too old to spend a decade or more on a book. But on the other hand, I think I've unfit myself for other careers, so I really am not sure what's going to happen next.
When you were sitting around the table talking about a book, your husband suggested that you write one on Calvin Coolidge because you were talking about doing one on the Roaring Twenties. Yeah. Was he serious about that?
He is, and I'll say that is filial affection. We both met when we were students at Amherst College in Western Massachusetts, and Calvin Coolidge is an alumnus of the college, the only president they have, and one who is not perhaps as warmly remembered as he could be. I actually wrote a little piece about Calvin Coolidge for the Alumni Magazine, and I decided we should change our mind about him. He is a fascinating, eccentric character, even if he is not perhaps, he's no FDR.
Well, you say in your acknowledgments, which I found very interesting, that you stumbled on Polly Adler's 1953 memoir, A House Is Not a Home, in the stacks of the Yale Library. Go back to that time. Tell us when it was, and how did you find it, and what was your immediate reaction?
Well, you know, I had finished my first book, a biography of a 19th century minister, one of the very first mega church ministers, a guy named Henry Ward Beecher, who is probably now best remembered as the little brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, the great abolitionist novel. And he was a great character, a similar character to Polly Adler in one sense, a kind of Forrest Gump kind of guy who could open up a lens on the 19th century. But it had taken so long, and biography is a crazy genre to be working in. It is always a long endeavor, even when you're doing it at your shortest. And as you say, I'd sworn I wasn't going to do it again. But then the book went well, unexpectedly well, and I think I was feeling flattered. So I thought, well, let's just think about it, something new. Why I decided to go off in a whole new direction still baffles me. But I was thinking the 20s because the Roaring Twenties, that year and those decades between World War I and World War II, are so critical to understanding where we are as Americans now. And they've got lots of glamour, lots of fun, you know, flappers and bootleggers and all that. So I was just looking through the books in the stacks of the library on the 20s, and there was this little slim red volume, nothing to distinguish it. But when I pulled it out, it turned out to be the memoir, 1953 memoir of this woman named Polly Adler, who it turned out was once a very, very famous or infamous madam in jazz age New York. And this was her autobiography called A House Is Not a Home. I took it home. I devoured it in one gulp. It is a fascinating story dealing with her life as a young girl from the immigrant, dealing with politicians and tastemakers and criminals. And then had some something of a happy ending, where this book that she published in the 1950s, long after she retired, became a mega bestseller, sold 2 million copies, was made into a movie with Shelley Winters. Not a very good movie, I have to say. Even had a song written under the same title, House Is Not a Home, by Burt Bacharach. And something about her story just grabbed me. And I thought, well, you know, even if there's not a whole lot more primary sources, this is enough to begin, enough to work with. And that took me down the rabbit hole, because it turned out, in fact, there were many, many more primary sources and many more stories than she even hinted at in her book.
And then you also mentioned about your former classmate, Rachel Rubin. Explain how she fit into this.
Well, I am not a superstitious person, unless the omens seem good. The minute the superstitious omens seem bad, I'm all logic after that. But there was something about this project that seemed to be blessed by the gods. The muses kept throwing little hints in my way. And one of the first bits of divine encouragement, if you will, was that one of my classmates, with whom I got my PhD at Yale, had just recently published a copy of an edition of How House Is Not a Home, with a lovely introduction that she'd written. And her first generous impulse, which I could not be more grateful for, was to hand me a stack of photocopied news articles. Now, this was back in the mid to late to 2007, 2008, when photocopies still mattered, when not everything was digitized. And I would have had to go back and laboriously look through all the microfilm. And so that was my first big landing of the fish, was, look at this. I've got obscure newspaper articles. Nothing makes a biographer or a historian more excited than a stack of obscure newspaper articles. But very quickly, more good omens, more good gifts started to appear. It turned out that Polly Adler had she really wanted to be remembered. She wanted to be respectable. She wanted to be a somebody, a mensch. She had kept stacks of old newspapers, clippings and programs and memorabilia, reel-to-reel tapes that she'd made, reminiscing about when she was writing her memoir, all sorts of things that, of course, would make a historian's heart leap. Sadly, her brother, her last surviving brother, was very ashamed of her, and he inherited all of this stuff, and in his shame about her profession, threw away most of it. But there was some, there was quite a bit. There were photos and enough to work from. So that was the next thing. Then, it turned out I found a note online by this fellow who was a demolition guy in Nebraska, and he had discovered in the course of his work a suitcase. And in this suitcase, it was filled with all the writing notes and correspondence of Polly Adler's ghostwriter, with whom she'd been working on this her memoir. And it had the real names. It had a lot of the names that had to be cut out and the things that had to be changed and in her memoir, which, of course, were plenty since much of her activity was illegal. And between those three things, I was off to the races. There were more gifts from the gods, but those three anchors made all the difference.
I don't want to go through the chronology of everything right now. We can come back to it. But give us a minute or two of the basics about who Polly Adler was.
Well, in some ways, she was a classic immigrant story from the 20th century. She was born around 1900. She was never quite sure exactly. She was born in the Pale of Russia, in an area that is now Belarus, that was known as White Russia at the time. And it was all under the Russian Empire. It was a Jewish shtetl, as they called it, and that was where she was born. But things were getting increasingly tough. Poverty, anti-Semitism were beginning to really squeeze the town. And her father decides, when Polly is about the age of 13, that they are going to all immigrate to the Golden Land of the United States. Unfortunately, they cannot afford to go all at the same time. It costs quite a lot of money. So he arranges for his oldest child, Polly, to go first. And they are going to follow in installments. She's going to help earn money send back and bring them over. And this was pretty common, not at all an uncommon thing, especially in the Jewish community where girls were so handy and so skillful and often even better than boys at handling the world outside. The trouble is, 6 months after she arrives in the United States, World War One arrives, shuts off all travel, all communication with Russia, and she is effectively stranded here in the United States, living among strangers. And it's at this point that her immigrant story starts to diverge from the standard path, and she has to decide how she's going to survive. She moves to New York, eventually, within a couple years, realizes that making $5 a week working in a garment factory is barely going to pay enough for her to live. And then she starts to look around. She has no parents. She has very little supervision, very little home life. She gets involved with the dance halls and the street life and other teenagers running wild in the ragtime era. In some ways, you know, the primrose path is not hard to get on. And she realizes she can make 3 to 4 to 5 times as much money, basically turning tricks. Men are willing to pay much more for her body than for her brain, she realizes. So by the time she's 20, she has opened her own brothel. She went very quickly from labor to management, as we would say, and opening her brothel with the opening of prohibition turned out to be the big fortuitous choice in her life. Within a couple of years, she has become the main entertainment venue for many of the up-and-coming bootleggers in New York, names that would become famous like Meyer Lansky, Lucky Luciano, Bugsy Siegel. She entertains Al Capone and all the big names. And that leads her very quickly to the culture makers, the writers like the Algonquin Roundtable become some of her biggest advocates, people in the entertainment business and advertising. And by the peak of Prohibition, when the 20s are really roaring, she has become something of a salon, if you will, a kind of late night bawdy salon with booze and girls and gambling for a lot of the big tastemakers and shakers and movers in the United States, in New York and thus in the United States, because she becomes a bit of a tourist spot. When people come to town, they want to be taken to Polly's. Of course, that can't last forever. The 30s come. The 30s are tougher. But she lasts. She lasts until 1945, when she finally decides she's too old for the business. She's got plenty of money, and she retires to California.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Lived 1900 and 1962, as you say. I want to do something that for people that have never been to New York City, because if you read your book and you don't understand New York City, you need a map in front of you. As a matter of fact, as they listen to this, they might benefit by having a map of New York City in front of them. And I want you to see if you can. Let's pretend that we're standing on 59th Street, right at the base of Central Park, facing north. On your right-hand side is East Side. On your left-hand side is the West Side. Kind of describe basically where everything is in your book. For instance, the Brooklyn, the Queens, the Riverside Drive, the tenement area, and things like that, so people can get a sense of what New York City would be like in those days.
The 1920s were the time when New York became the most powerful city in the nation and the most powerful city on earth for a time. And so when she first arrives, she goes out to what was then a Jewish ghetto out in the far reaches of Brooklyn, Brownsville, Brooklyn. And that's where she discovers, to hell with poverty. I don't need any more of this. If being respectable means I have to stay here in this ghetto, then I don't care about respectability. So she takes the train across Brooklyn, which is a big, massive borough, to Manhattan, which is despite being one of the biggest, greatest cities in the country, is actually in many ways a very small place, just a little island. She first begins down at the Lower East Side, which is not a whole lot better than Brownsville, Brooklyn. It's a place filled with crime. It is now remembered, of course, as a place where many Jews and Irish began their start as immigrant families and moved up and out. And in that sense, she followed that path. She begins her life in crime down on the Lower East Side, but she quickly, as she gets a little more money, she moves up to what they called All Right Nick's Row, which is going up on the west side of Central Park, as you say. Her first brother was actually right next to Columbia University, which I believe was a wise choice. Lots of rich pickings there. And that's a place where the people who had made some money down wherever they first immigrated to were beginning to move up there, almost as if they were like an airy sort of suburb, because the streets were cleaner, the buildings were newer, and it was a great place to start off her career. But as she gets a little more fame, a little more notoriety, as her ambitions grow, she realizes that the real action is happening in Midtown Manhattan. And that is right underneath Central Park. It is at that time the center of business in the world. It's right next to Grand Central train station, Penn Station. So you've got people from all over the country coming into New York and staying in these hotels, doing business. And you've also got, it's also the center of entertainment, the wine, women, and song racket. That's where all of the great speakeasies are. It's where all the big nightclubs, the illegal nightclubs that the bootleggers are setting up. It is, in many ways, the center, the heart of New York City. And that's where she really makes her fame, is in the center of the city in Midtown. But of course, as things go along, crime also begins. You know, it's a time where criminals are kind of chic. There's nothing like making booze illegal to all of a sudden give it a certain kind of cultural cachet. Now, all of a sudden, it seems glamorous to sit next to a bootlegger because they're the ones who supplied the booze. And she benefits from that. But as the Depression hits, a lot of the glamour of the criminal world disappears as the economy goes downhill, as liquor becomes legal again in 1933. So she has to move over to the Upper East Side, which would shock people who know New York, because the Upper East Side is to this day still a bastion of respectable wealth. It was very WASPy then, filled with Protestants and somewhat snobbish. I mean, perhaps even still, but that's what her finer clientele, including Jock Whitney of the Whitney and Fortune. He is one of her close friends and one of her best clients. And he says, look, if you don't move someplace safer, I can't keep coming here because the kidnapping has just gotten too much. And I am a prime person to be kidnapped. So she ends her career mostly over in the respectable East Side, although even there, she has her problems. The Stork Club, which was the hotspot of cafe society, once kicks her out. Not just kicks her out of the club, which she finds humiliating, but the proprietor, Sherman Billingsley, actually, when he orders her to leave and she will not leave with her girls, he actually brings waiters over, tells them to remove the table in front of her because he will not have a whore in his establishment, which, of course, was I probably shouldn't cast aspersions, but I will, which was, of course, ridiculous rank hypocrisy, since the Stork Club was filled with ladies of the evening who just passed as respectable people.
To review a couple of things, you talk about Prohibition, 1920, 18th Amendment, 1933 21st Amendment when they repealed it. So she was most, was she most active during the time of Prohibition?
She was, she had quite, actually what's interesting is she felt like her, the great years of when the town was running wide open in the 20s, when Jimmy Walker, the jazz mayor, as they called him, was in charge, were in many ways her best years because, as I say, the criminals had a kind of chic cachet and she didn't get, she had to pay out tons in bribes. But she was not molested, really. She was arrested, and certainly things were tough. There's nothing like having gangsters as, you know, as your primary clients to have plenty of run-ins with both the law and the underworld. It was a very dangerous business to begin with and made more dangerous by having a bunch of coked up gun toters in your midst. But in fact, as she herself says, the 30s were harder. But in fact, there was still plenty of money around if you knew where to find it. And New York City was becoming this very international city because of the lead up of World War II. There were plenty of people coming in from Europe who had plenty of money to spend. And that's the sort of the hot years for what used to be called cafe society, when the big nightclubs were the Stork Club and the El Morocco. And she was, and the 21 Club, and she was essentially the house madam for all the hot nightclubs. You would call her if somebody wanted something more than a good dinner and some booze. The head waiter might give you her phone number, or she would bring her girls to the nightclubs and use them as advertisement, and you might follow her home. So her 30s, in many ways, she was just as popular, and she was making as almost as much money. But it just got harder. It's not, especially, it's a young woman's game at its best. And I think she was getting older. I think she was, the abuse adds up. So even though those were not her favorite years, in many ways, she was probably more famous worldwide during the 30s than she was in the 20s.
Going back to New York, if you were down in the Lower East Side, your Brooklyn is over to your right across the river. Queens above them over to your right on the east side. And then on the left side would be Hudson River, and it would include other places that I want to ask you just to give us a definition. What would be the Tenderloin District? And what does that mean?
It's funny. The Tenderloin, that's an old word. It's said to come from a cop slang, which is one of the things that might shock people reading this book. Certainly there were times when I was shocked, was the level of police corruption that existed in those decades, especially if you were in the vice squad. And there's still some of that today in vice squads. The Tenderloin was where the bribes were best. So a cop who was being transferred from walking a respectable beat somewhere in a quiet neighborhood, if they got transferred to, say, the areas around Times Square or the areas where Tin Pan Alley was, which was where all the music saloons and the music publishers were clustered around in the 30s, just below Times Square. Those places, the cops would say, I've got transferred. We're not having Chuck Steak anymore. It's all going to be Tenderloin out from here because the bribes were so much thicker and more profitable. And one of the things is I realized is there is a specific place, the Times Square and below that in the 30s and going along Broadway, the Great White Way, as they called it, because it had so many electric lights so early on, were the, any place where you had a lot of saloons and you had a lot of brothels would be one of those kind of red light districts. But it turns out, yes, there was a main Tenderloin under around Times Square, but there were little pockets like that throughout New York City. And in fact, up until World War One, most towns, even small towns, had districts, red light districts, where the worst of the saloons, the worst of the music halls, and of course the brothels would all be clustered around certain areas. And those were pretty much, even if they weren't exactly legal, they were tolerated because there was a real belief that there were good women and there were bad women, and it's best, we're going to have some bad women anyway. Let's all know where they are. Let's keep them all in their district. Everyone, if you want to go there, you can, but then they won't be spread throughout the city, infecting the rest of us, I guess, was sort of the idea. World War One changes that because you've got all these young boys in uniform who are going to France or going to training camps, and they are coming back with all kinds of sexually transmitted diseases because this is their first foray out into the world to dealing with prostitutes and looser young women. And the army is so worried that they are going to lose more soldiers to syphilis or to gonorrhea than they are to bullets, that they it basically closed down, issue national regulations to close down all the red light districts in the country. And that is, like Prohibition, one of the great accomplishments of the 20th century. We no longer have wide open vice districts. It did not succeed entirely. We still have prostitution, just like we still have liquor. But it definitely cut down on the number of these kind of tenderloin districts and cut down, of course, on police corruption for that reason.
Where is Hell's Kitchen in Manhattan, and how does that relate in your story?
Yeah, so Hell's Kitchen is sort of the prime tenderloin. That is the 30s, the blocks below Times Square. Times Square is from 42nd to 49th on Broadway, going up along the crooked little street of Broadway. If you just keep going south, the lower 40s, they used to call them the Roaring 40s, and the 30s, and the 20s, going further south on the west side, it's what they call still Hell's Kitchen, although nobody finds that name as appropriate as they used to. It was actually a primarily Irish area, Irish and African American. And it's still got a little bit of an Irish flavor. And if you go there to this day, it is not as by any means as rough as it was. Nothing in New York City is as rough as it was, but it's still you can see the old tenements and you can see the little Irish bars. And that's where many of the great Irish criminals in New York history came from.
How many different places?
The Jewish criminals came from the Lower East Side. The Irish came from the West Side.
How many different places did Polly Adler live in while she was alive in New York City?
That is a question I honestly cannot answer. In fact, when I was looking at her ghostwriter, brilliant woman named Virginia Faulkner, she is writing to the editor of the book of Polly's House is Not a Home. And she says, I literally cannot tell how many places she lived. I have addresses. I have at least 25 addresses or more. And she says she herself cannot remember all the places she had apartments. And that's because a couple reasons. One is that she had to always be on the run from cops or from stick up men who, you know, when you work outside the law, you cannot always turn to the law if you're being robbed. So she had to always be a little bit one step ahead of the people who were trying to either shut her down or take her money. Or sometimes she'd just run into problems. The neighbors would start to complain, or the superintendent didn't want to take her bribes anymore, or some of her clients would cause a fuss and make a noise and she had to shut down and move along. But the other reason is once you shut down these tenderloin districts, these brothel districts, before you could kind of have a wide open brothel. The old brothels in New York City before Polly's time used to actually have advertisements that they would put up on the windows of their brownstones, or they would have guidebooks. That gentlemen's guidebooks, as they were called, that would list the addresses. Well, you know, once there's a crackdown, that's no longer okay. So they move into these big apartment buildings. So Polly likes to live in big, anonymous apartment buildings that are the new thing in New York because you can't see. You can't see it. You can't know exactly who's living in those buildings. But that means also that the brothels are smaller. You don't have a whole house to have 10 women living in. So she had, she would have a main brothel or a couple main places where she would have gambling rooms and a bar, and you could kind of, as she liked to call it, it was like a speakeasy with a harem that you could drop by and have a drink. And even if you didn't want to sleep with one of her girls, you might chat with Polly and have a snack and a couple of overpriced cocktails or play cards. But she also had to have plenty of space for what we now call call girls. She worked by telephone. So sometimes you might go to her house, but other times, if you were a man who wanted to go on a date with one of her ladies, you would call up and she would either send somebody to you, call up one of the girls in her big book, her directory of women who worked for her, and she would either send the girl to go to your place, or she had a whole set of apartments scattered across the city that you could meet up with your date in one of her apartments. So she herself, she could never say how many places she lived in, nor could she say how many times she had been arrested. We know at least 15 times she was arrested, but it had to be countless more. Even she and the cops agree it was many more. They just can't figure out how many.
How many times did she go to jail?
Only one time. She was a clever woman, and she was especially popular with the cops. That was one of her big innovations. Was she said, you know, I don't want to pay off after I've been arrested. I'm going to make myself a home away from home for all the vice cops in the city who would get in the habit of stopping by whenever they wanted to drink or roll in the hay for free, or they wanted to pick up a little extra bribe. So as she said, she got very adept at the $100 handshake, putting a C note in her palm and just going around shaking the various cops' hands. And that helped a lot. You'd be amazed how much paying people off ahead of time keeps you from being the one pinched at the end of the month. But, you know, if you work constantly in the underworld, you will be arrested. So she was, but only one time did she ever make it to jail. And that was in 1935. She only went for a month with 5 days off for good behavior. But the real reason, I think, it's not entirely clear, but it looks like the reason this time she went down finally was because one of her most famous clients who spent a lot of time hiding out in her apartments was a major gangster named Dutch Schultz. He often nicknamed the Beer Baron of the Bronx. And he had risen to becoming one of the most powerful criminals in the country. And now the feds and the city were trying to take him down. And I think she sort of got caught up in the web of trying to take him down. And she was going to be a pawn to try to do that. It did not work, actually. In the end, her good friend Lucky Luciano intervened for her. That's why she was only there for a month. And she keeps her mouth shut. That was one of the secrets to her success. She was very discreet, very good at keeping her mouth shut. And in the end, it wasn't New York City who got Dutch Schultz. It wasn't the feds who got Dutch Schultz. It was one of his fellow gangsters, a set of fellow gangsters who got sick of taking orders from him and killed him famously in a saloon in New Jersey.
What would be the differences if you read A House Is Not a Home compared to what you have in your book?
Oh, well, first of all, let me say A House Is Not a Home is a great read. So well worth the pleasure of picking it up. And as I say, shorter and slimmer. The difference is, you know, she was very, as I say, very discreet. So she names very few people. You have to already be dead and you're probably a gangster because she's more comfortable. But on the other hand, when I looked at the the notes from her ghostwriter, there's a list in the back of the ghostwriter's notebook that says people not to be named. Well, that list has about 20 of the single most famous notorious gangsters in the country on it. And this happens to be right around the Kefauver hearings in 1950-51. So she clearly doesn't mention anyone who she might get in trouble alive. So it's one thing. So one of the biggest differences is real names and the real details. Even her own family, she doesn't speak much about. And some of those names and details really matter. For example, the biggest surprise that I had, I knew that she dealt with a lot of politicians. Politicians were some of her best customers. I knew that her house was a place where gangsters and politicians liked to meet because they could do business away from prying eyes, and it was very safe. But the big shock was when speaking to one of her friends, when I spoke to him, he was in his 80s, a man who had known Polly when he was just in his 20s, and Polly was near the end of her life. She was already sick with lung cancer, the lung cancer that would kill her in 1962. And he just out of the blue told me, near the end of her life, she mentioned that FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, the saint of the Democrats, that he had been one of her customers, that she had provided women for him. And it was before he became president. It's not exactly clear if it was when he was governor or I think a little bit before he became governor. And that not just that he had been a customer of hers, but that her discretion, her willingness to keep that a secret when he ran for president, had been paid back handsomely, that she was to the end of her life receiving payments, regular payments from prominent Democrats to keep her mouth shut. As you can imagine, that one was a big shock. That probably added a whole extra year of me researching, trying to figure out if I could actually pin that down and find out if it was true. I was never able to confirm it as factually true. However, it is possible, and not only that, it is somewhat likely that there's a lot of good reason to think that would be true, and there's no reason to think that she would just lie out of the blue. And that's, of course, where being a biographer is a little less savory. We are, by profession, peeping Toms. So I spent a lot of time looking at, FDR's sexual habits. Could he have sex? What does his doctor say? Turns out he loved stag parties. Even in the White House, every year for his birthday, he threw a full stag party with all of the trimmings. It turns out he could indeed have sex, as his doctor said, in the French manner, as they put it then. There were many stories like that don't appear in her book, as you can imagine.
FDR was Assistant Secretary of the Navy between 1913 and 1920. And then there was a gap of 9 years before he became governor, 1929 to 1932, before obviously he became president. So there was that 9-year gap where she was very active.
My guess, and this is really speculation, informed speculation, but it is speculation, is that I know that he, after he is first paralyzed, he is basically in seclusion trying to get his health back and trying to get the use of his legs back. He begins to make a comeback in 1924 when Al Smith runs for president. But he is still not very much in the New York scene. My guess is that around the time that Al Smith is going to run again in 1928 for the presidency, and he desperately wants FDR to run for governor of New York because he needs to have New York in his pocket. And he needs to have, if he doesn't have New York, he has no chance of winning the nomination for the presidency from the Democrats. So he manages to convince FDR to leave his hot springs, to leave the warm springs where he is in Georgia, and to come back up to New York and run for governor. Here at this point, up until now, Roosevelt has been, you know, the Hudson Valley aristocrat. He's not part of the ethnic mix of New York City politics. He's sort of aloof. He's a Harvard man. He's a WASP, a high Protestant. But he has started to be taken up by the crowd of politicians, the Tammany Hall crowd that runs with Polly's group. So he begins to be, he has people like Jack Dempsey, who Polly knew very well, come out and endorse him. Jack Dempsey's former trainer, Teddy Hayes, becomes FDR's masseuse. During that period of time while he's trying to figure out if he can get his use of his legs back to run for governor. And I believe that this fella, Teddy Hayes, who had been a big boxing promoter and trainer, a big political go-between, very much part of that Tammany Hall sporting, gambling, bootlegger crowd, and a very good customer of Polly's, who she knew very well. I think he was the liaison, if it's true, he would be able to say, I can get you somebody discreetly who can come see you at the Biltmore Hotel. And at the same time, this is an unfortunate fact, but one of the ways that prostitutes serve the underworld and serve less savory causes is they become their own subtle form of blackmail. So many of Polly's people were very deeply, as I say, a lot of the gangsters were very deeply involved in Democratic politics and Republican politics, actually. And so it is quite likely that they might well have said, let's facilitate Roosevelt having a couple encounters with some of Polly's women, because that's its own subtle form of blackmail. They have something on him, whether he knows it or not. They have something on him, and that's true in business. That's true in not just in politics. It's true in all kinds of places that if you, it's called the power of shared transgression. That if you have two men have gone and done something illegal together or just immoral together, something that they are forbidden to do, it often will create a little bond, especially if you get away with it. And I think that's a lot of the times when people were hiring Polly girls for official purposes, that's what they're trying to do. They're doing the equivalent of all going to a strip club after a business meeting to bond together. And if the bonds don't work just for friendship, then you know you have a little something to hold over your customer or your client or your new friend. And so that's my guess how it would have worked. It is also said, and this with much more authority, that Huey Long was a customer of Polly's. And there's some reason to think that some of Huey Long's decisions as it came down to supporting Roosevelt for the nomination for the presidency might also have been in relationship to the gangsters who circulated in Polly's world. And it is known for sure that Huey Long liked to go to Polly's house when he was in the Senate.
You have said the reason to write a book is research. Explain.
Yes. That's the fun part. That's the Sherlock Holmes part. That's the, you know, the pleasure of having a hunch and following it out and poking around in other people's old letters. And, you know, as I say, you get some of the pleasures of the peeping Tom here. And that's one of the reasons I like to work with dead people, because it's harder to do the research because dead people don't give up their secrets as easily and you can't ask them direct questions. But on the other hand, I think it eases my conscience a little bit that I am not invading the privacy of real live living people and I am not going to hurt anybody's feelings or step on anybody's toes. That's the thing. If I were going to write another book, that's the part that I like. The writing part, that's just the price you have to pay for spending all those hours in the archives and reading old newspapers, looking at other people's diaries.
How many different physical places did you go to during your research to get an idea of what this woman was like?
That's a really interesting question, because with my first book, the Beechers were a very prominent 19th century family, and they spent most of their years in New England and Brooklyn Heights, which is the very first historic district, National Historic District in the country. So the places that he lived were pretty well preserved. You can go up to Litchfield, where he was born in Connecticut, or you can go to Brooklyn Heights, where his church still stands and is very active. You can see where he lived, and you can see the spaces where he spent time. With Polly, most of those places don't look the same. You know, New York City just grows and grows and changes, never sits still. So in fact, her brothel, her main brothel on West 54th Street, a couple blocks south of Central Park, stood up until this summer. That was one of the few places I could go to and point to and say, look at this building. This is where she spent most of her the 20s, where so many people did. You would never know. It was just a nondescript little building. And I went there August to take a reporter there for New York Magazine, and it had just been knocked down because New York is always changing. So I did a lot more sitting and reading newspapers and reading old magazines. I read tabloids. I was never a fan of the tabloid newspaper, but now I am. Boy, they get in all kinds of gossip. They say all the things that people won't say in the respectable newspapers. So this was a work as much of my historical imagination, trying to imagine what it was like to be in these old spaces, as it was to actually get to see it.
You talk about there is a difference between an academic book and a popular history book. Tell us what that is.
Well, my sentences should be shorter. I'll say that. I'm hoping, you know, your words don't need to all be 50-cent words, and your sentences don't all need to be three clauses too long. So that's one thing. Some of it is just presentation. Some of it is, you know, you have to be, it's a matter of emphasis. So if I were really going to be writing this for an academic audience, my footnotes would have been quite elaborate. As it is, I have 100 pages of footnotes and bibliography, because I felt very strongly that there's a lot of myth making about the Roaring Twenties and the Jazz Age, and there's a lot of myth spinning about gangsters and flappers, and there's a lot of lie telling in Polly's world, and Polly is not the biggest liar of them all by any means. That's one of the things that I came to realize, is we have, kind of one of the things I feel very strongly about, is that we have a tendency to treat, well, for example, people involved in the sex trades as if somehow they are less likely to tell the truth than the men who go spend time with the women in the sex trades, when in fact it's quite the opposite. The people who have the most to lose are usually the ones who are most willing to lie. She entertained some of the biggest businessmen in the country, and you'd be hard pressed to find any one of them telling the truth about their experiences. So a big part of it is not that different, because I tried very hard to get to the original sources, to distinguish truth from fanciful storytelling. And I did my best to document it, but I tried to make it more entertaining. And in fact, that's one of the reasons to write a biography, because biographies are about characters that let you see the person going through history, see the person living in their time and place, and in a way that maybe a regular history book would be a little drier. It wouldn't be as personal. You're not seeing the world through somebody's eyes. You're just seeing the world through me as the omniscient narrator. So that was part of the pleasure, was seeing the 20th century through Polly's eyes.
What would she look like if you were seeing her in person? How tall was she? How much did she weigh? Was she, in your opinion, attractive?
Well, you know, you've hit on something that she herself commented on a number of times. She's tiny, like many immigrants to the United States from poorer countries at that time. She was 4'12 at the 4'11. I mean, barely 5 feet. If she had heels on, she might be a little tiny bit over 5 feet. Everyone was much shorter in those days. And she was very cute, especially as a younger person, a little cupid doll face. You might easily mistake her for somebody who was not as formidable as she was until she talked. And she had a very deep foghorn voice, and she could swear when she wanted to, when she had a bit of a temper when she let it go, so that she was very demure looking. She designed her own clothes. She dressed very respectably, although she did have a little bit of a weakness for mink coats and for flashy jewelry. So you wouldn't necessarily know that she was a madam or a woman of the night until she talked. And then she had a fairly thick, what she called a Delancey Street accent from the Lower East Side, kind of a mix of Jewish, Yiddish accent, kind of Broadway lingo like you might hear in Damon Runyon, and you know, pop culture-y. And in fact, she was quite cute and quite beloved. People really loved her, but she didn't age so well. And as she herself said, I had to be a madam. I couldn't be a hustler, meaning a prostitute, because I wasn't pretty enough. And that may be true. Certainly, it's a job. Prostitution is a job for the young and the attractive. That's where the money lies. It's not a good, most people, their good years of earning are only about five. If you stay in the business for 10, that's a long time, and you're not going to be better for it. But the other thing is, she was smart, and she could see that the world was kinder on the people who were in charge than the people, the management. Always better to be management, I think, was her decision there.
Had she ever married?
She did not. And in fact, her love life was, I think, a source of great disappointment and pain to her. She certainly had boyfriends. Her turning point, the way she tells it, between her respectable life and her path down to sin, I guess we could say, to vice and lawbreaking, was when she was 17, she fell in love with her boss at the garment factory where she sewed corsets. And he seemed to be interested in her. She thought it was, they were going to have an affair. Well, he ends up taking her out to Coney Island and raping her. She gets pregnant. He refuses to marry her. He refuses to help pay for an abortion, which is pretty common then. They're all illegal, but they are quite existent. So she needs to scrape up enough money to have an abortion. And she gets kicked out of her parents' her cousin's home. Her parents still are not there. She's living with cousins in Brooklyn. And the way to make money fast, she starts to realize, is to turn tricks. And she can make, so much more money. And I think the thing that really she starts to realize is, why would I go back? Why would I go back to being square? Why would I go back to the respectable world when so far the respectable world has done nothing for me and would just be as happy to see me starve? And it starts to look, I think, for a lot of people who choose the sex trades. Not everyone chooses to participate. There's plenty of coercion, and there's plenty of terrible pressure to be in the sex trades. But there are also women who decide that this is the path that makes the most sense to them, whether it's a good path or not, whether it's the path they would have chosen or not. They decide this is the best path they have, the best option they have in front of them. And it's at that point where Polly realizes, there is nothing for me here in the respectable world. I might as well make as much money as I can, and maybe I can buy some respectability.
As I read your book, I kept writing names down, and I want to read a list of them. You can interrupt and say if she did not provide women to these men, but the list is extraordinary, and I didn't even get to all of them. George S. Kaufman, Dorothy Parker. Of course, she wasn't there for
I don't believe so. She was just there for the drinking and the hanging out.
Desi Arnaz, Robert Benchley, Mayor Jimmy Walker, Jack Dempsey, policemen, many policemen, Walter Winchell, the Marx Brothers, Milton Berle, Joe DiMaggio, you mentioned, Frank Sinatra, Lucky Luciano, Al Capone, Dutch Schultz, Bugsy Siegel, Frank Costello, Legs Diamond, Arnold Rothstein, Oney Madden, Bill Dwyer, George McManus, Jimmy Hines, Charles Murphy. Who did I leave out?
Well, Winthrop Rockefeller, she entertained many of the Vanderbilt boys who were known to be quite racy in their tastes. John Hay Whitney, who was one of the world's wealthiest men at the time, and as much as we have to being an American aristocrat, was one of her regular clients. Many newspapermen who went on to become screenwriters, who helped create the gangster genre and the screwball comedy genre of the 1930s and 40s, got the DNA of American Hollywood while hanging out in Polly's Parlor. There are so many more people. She said, for one thing, the advertising industry was one of her biggest set of clients, as you can imagine. If you have watched Mad Men, that was a tame version. So she mentions quietly in some of her correspondence that the legendary ad firm BBD&O was her biggest corporate client. You name it, the Madison Square Garden crowd, the boxing crowd was huge. There was probably not a boxer in the firmament of the 30s who did not come to her house. I could have spent years just going on looking for more names. I tried to be not discreet. How would I say? I tried to be very clear. I was not going to put people in her house unless I knew for sure that they had been to her house or been her clients. But there are many people that she knew. And here's a late breaking item. Just last week, just before Christmas, I got an email from someone who said, I heard about your book about Polly Adler. I have an early manuscript of Polly Adler's memoir that has notes scrawled all over it, and it's clearly been edited, or it's meant to be edited, and there's all kind of editing notes in it from other people. It was given to my parents by Polly herself, because we knew the family, and I got on the phone with him saying, well, this is, of course, something you can imagine. In my research, I knew there were earlier manuscripts of her memoir. I knew it because I could see the correspondence with her publisher and her editor and her agent. But I didn't think it still existed. I have not yet seen it, but it seems to me that this is going to be a manuscript that has a whole bunch of things that were cut out. So, for example, when Polly is trying to get permission to use people's names in the book, people like James Thurber, the humorist, or Walter Winchell, all say, no thanks. You know, it was one thing to be your friend and to be your client, but no, I don't need you listing my name in your book. So people like Dorothy L'Amour, the actress, worked for Polly. I think a lot of those names are going to be in this manuscript, and I just haven't seen it yet. I think it's coming next week. If it's something big, trust me, we'll all hear more about it, even if it's too late to be put in the book.
We're going to wrap it up, but before we do that, I want to ask you about one other major story in your book. Judge Seabury, Mayor Jimmy Walker, who was mayor of New York City 1926 to 32, and FDR, who was governor during part of that time. Explain the Seabury Commission.
Well, you know, of course, as I was saying, corruption was pretty high in general in New York City. It was just taken for granted that there would be a certain amount of corruption. That's just the way politics worked back then. Pay for play. But that grows tremendously during the Prohibition years because you've got all this criminal money due to the illegal liquor trade. So the corruption grows to a peak. Well, then all of a sudden the Depression happens and people are not as tolerant of public money being squandered like this. And so there starts to be pressure to investigate. Judge Samuel Seabury, a very respectable, very upright man, very uncorruptible judge, is put in charge of this. The Seabury investigation, as it's called, takes over the news, takes over the government for about two and a half years, while FDR is governor in part because FDR wants to run for president. He can't be having scandals breaking out constantly in the biggest city in his state. So he's got some pressure to try to clean up the city. Of course, he's also got some pressure from the people in the city, from the politicians, Tammany Hall, to not bust up their what the good thing they've got going on. So it's a very high wire act that Roosevelt is in, and Polly is really caught in the middle, because if you want to know anything about political corruption or police corruption, she could tell you almost everything there is to know about it, or at least a good portion. She could get you on the way. And so she becomes caught up in the middle of it. She ends up going on the run. She leaves for Miami, possibly spend some time in Cuba. But eventually she's out of money and has to come back. And that's around the time that she becomes most famous, because she is caught up in the scandals around not just Jimmy Walker, but there's a very famous case of if you're of a certain age, you might remember the name Judge Crater. He disappeared in the middle of these municipal scandals, never to be seen again. And for years, people were on the hunt for him. People would think they were having sightings of Judge Crater across America, just like we might say we saw Bigfoot. And there is some rumor, I don't have this for sure, that he may have died in Polly's parlor. How is not exactly clear. And of course, we don't, maybe this new manuscript that I've discovered will have the answer to that. But she found herself over and over again right at the heart of anything nasty happening in the political sphere. Chances were good that she was there. She was the Forrest Gump of Vice for a while there.
Last couple of questions. I take it you met your husband at Amherst?
I did, yes.
Now, he seems to like writing books.
Yeah, you know, you mean because he has like 25 of them?
Yeah.
In the same time. Listen, it's a source of some tension around here, because the thing is about writing biographies, it's no way to make a living, for heaven's sakes. You get all the penury of bohemia and all the punctiliousness of being in the petty bourgeoisie, keeping account books, and not a lot of cash. So part of what he keeps saying is, listen, you wrote these two great books, you won the Pulitzer Prize, great, that's all wonderful. How about you write like a political thriller or something, and that really sells? And my problem is, it's not easy to write fiction. I don't know how people do it. My husband writes business books. I don't know if it's easy or not. All I know is he's written a lot of them and people buy them. So there's a little bit of envy on my part with his speed and with his accuracy. So check in with me next year, and either I will have gotten a job doing something, or I will be embarked on, I don't know, writing a thriller. or maybe I'll just retire and putter around the garden.
By the way, what's the correct way to pronounce your husband's last name?
Bruce Tulgan, T-U-L-G-A-N. He is probably most famous for a book called It's Okay to Be the Boss, which sells and sells and sells, even though it's been out for about 10 years. Because apparently people all want to be the boss, but then once they actually are in charge, it's awkward, and it's not easy to do, and people don't really know how to be the boss. So it's amazing how much people still care about that book.
For the last hour, we've been talking about a book called Madam, the biography of Polly Adler, icon of the jazz age. And our guest has been the author of that book, Debbie Applegate. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Couldn't have been more fun.
Thanks for listening. Please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We would love to hear from you. You can email us at podcasts@c-span.org.